From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, a study examines which factors, including race, affect the ability of low-income children to succeed later in life. Then a Sherman Park resale shop doubles as work training for some at-risk youth.
A lot of our young people have been said no to a lot. And so we say, come on in, let's establish some professional expectations and let's see if you can rise to that.
Later, we meet an author who's doing a multi-state book tour by bicycle.
One of the most fun things, actually, is when things go wrong. Maybe not in that exact moment when the thing goes wrong, but it always leads you to meeting such kind, generous people.
And we hear the next audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. It's nice to have you listening today. We all know that children who grow up in disadvantaged homes face unique challenges to their well-being and their chances for success later in life. But growing up in low-income circumstances isn't a blanket predictor of a child's future. Some may do well, some may struggle. But are there factors that could predict a child's future situation? Do children of a particular demographic fare better than those of another in the long run? How much depends on a child's ability to grow and make his own future, and how much is out of his control? These were the questions asked by three researchers at Johns Hopkins University. In a groundbreaking study, they tracked low-income children in Baltimore, Maryland over the course of 25 years, and just this past April published their results in a book called The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. To help us parse through the conclusions, Lake Effect's Real Talk contributor David Pate joins me in the studio. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's great to be back as always.
So why might looking at the example of low-income children's long-term well-being in Baltimore be helpful to us here in Milwaukee?
The one thing this study does that is really unique is the first study of its kind that looks at 25 years of data, longitudinally, as you mentioned, but also Baltimore is very much like Milwaukee. It lost industry, which was factories in the 70s. It lost a lot of economic opportunities for those who were low income, who had a high school degree or less. It lost a lot of the security it had in the city for people to be able to maintain their well-being and their life. But the one thing that I think is really most important is that they have very high concentrations of poverty in certain parts of Baltimore, very much like Milwaukee, where we're seeing some outcomes by race and gender that are very unique, that are very applicable to a city like Milwaukee. And that's why this is the first study of its kind to show cities similar to a Milwaukee or a Chicago or a St. Louis or cities that are experiencing some of these pockets of poverty. What can we do that can maybe eradicate some of the issues that they have around their well-being that could be challenges for the future? So it's really a very exciting and important study that's been done by Johns Hopkins that I'm very excited to talk about that we can learn something from in the city of Milwaukee.
What were some of the points of interest that the study authors tracked over these 25 years?
They looked at how well students did in school. They looked at whether or not when these young men and women turned 18, did they get a job? Did they have jobs while they were teenagers? What were some of their health outcomes? They looked at what were some of their issues of stress they dealt with over time. But most importantly, the main thing they wanted to look at is do people who have come out of these very poor communities by race and gender succeed differently? Do they have some resiliency within their own lives, or they have some other kind of strengths that we haven't really documented that we can learn from? The other thing about this study is it looks at white men and poor white men. We don't often talk about poor white men or poor white women, and how do they do in these same very similar communities?
Well, so looking at all groups, what were some of the factors that the study authors found made a difference in these low-income children growing into successful adulthood?
The first thing they talk about is this whole idea that your family's a launching pad and there's family resources. For example, I looked at some, when I was reading the study, they talked about males, two sets of males, black males and white males. They both had incarceration rates. They both had dropout issues. They both had children at early ages. They also had job experiences. Some of them went to college. But if you look at it by race, the white men still did better you know, even though they had the exact same low-income salaries, their parents were making less than $25,000 a year, and they were in what we would call a concentrated poverty community where poverty was above 40% of everyone in that community. But you still saw that these parents who were white had social networks that led to a job, that led to some kind of consistent employment. That employment could be my son can work at your electrician shop and learn how to be an electrician or learn how to be a carpenter or learn how to do some other kind of work because I know someone in the construction business. Where for the black families, they didn't have those same networks. They had a higher concentration of incarceration. They had a lot more stress around violence in their community, which was slightly different than the white community. And so the social networking is something I think is really important that I think we underplay often by race. But I have seen in Milwaukee that a lot of people who I talk to, particularly men, don't have those same social networks. This access to employment was very different, and it made a big difference for future outcomes for men. And they also found that these families also had a little bit more stability around, even though they may be poor, they had a little bit more stability on family members they could fall back on for a rainy day. If something went wrong and it didn't really work for them, they could call up a family member and say, I need to live with you. Where for someone who was black, they were finding it was a lot harder to have some of that same type of resources. So human resources or human capital within these families was just very different, even though slight differences made a big difference in how they were able to have successful outcomes.
Well, so one of my concerns then when we're talking about family structure and the impact of that is that you sometimes will get into people blaming the victim, talking about people's individual choices or perhaps just some differences. We've talked about how many black families aren't married, but they're still committed partners. The fathers are still involved. But there's this stereotype, and it comes down to choices instead of looking at real structural issues like you've been talking about that create challenges that these families might experience.
Well, you know, the one thing about the one thing I want to address, you said they're not married. In these white families, there was a higher rate of marriage. You're exactly right. The reality is 73% of black kids are born to single parents. But they also have, what I have found in my research, but also what people have found most recently federally, is that black fathers are some of the most involved fathers in the country. And this is through a CDC study that was released. But also, from my own research, I see oftentimes a lot of black men who are very involved. So there is a reality, and I'm going to be truthful, that there are the most black kids are born into a family that is a single parent. That's the truth. And with single parent families, there is more challenges and barriers to success or possible barriers to success. However, many single mothers are doing a fabulous job of raising their children. And also, many of these men are involved, and we tend to buy into a stereotype that these men are not involved. I mean, one of the men that we had on one of our interviews previously, Armando, is a very involved father. In fact, is raising his child. And I see more men like that than I see less men. However, we also have one of the highest incarceration rates of men, so men are not around. A study that just came out last week from two University of Chicago professors showed that over the last 50 years, black men are nowhere near the same level of socioeconomic status as white men. There has not been much progress at all.
But so the point basically is that when we look at a factor like family cohesion as being a benefit for children's longitudinal well-being, it doesn't take one form, that
exactly.
We really need to look at the individual families
exactly.
And what's going on there.
And I can't stress enough, this access to employment is something that is glaring. And yeah, we can say blame the victim, that they should work harder. But these families were all both working at the same level of opportunity, whatever was available to them for opportunities to do better in their lives, it was there. However, they're finding that there's something around what we are less fearful of or what we are able to trust, whom we are able to trust. So the issue of race has been a discussion. University of Chicago did a really big study on their business school that race is still a real issue. And there's one guy from MDRC said, we have people who will say to us, I'm scared of this young black man because of his presence, how he looks. I don't know why that is, but the reality is I am still nervous about that. So we can say, yes, you can blame the victim, but there is something structurally going on that we as a society and as a community need to have a real discussion about.
Well, and we've seen that represented here in studies done in Milwaukee. I'm thinking of the Diva Pager study showing that a white man with lesser educational attainment actually has a better chance than a black man with a higher educational attainment in getting a job.
Exactly. And this is playing out more and more as we look at what are some of the factors. And I think that what I even saw with my own academic colleagues is this discomfort with being labeled as a racist when you have these kind of conversations. And I don't think people will be – I think that we have to put it on the table. This is the reality. We have to get real about a real discussion on what are some of the factors. Some of it is definitely individual, personal. You just didn't do it right. You didn't do something right. You made a mistake, or you just didn't think correctly in doing what you're doing. But there is some structural issues around how we perceive certain types of men and women in our society, and we need to do a better job at acknowledging that. And also, one thing the study made me think about, which I had to bring up my own bias, we don't think of white people as poor. We don't put the same type of characterization on it. It says when we think of black people being poor, it's almost like it's a norm. But for white people, we think that must just be a mistake and it must be just temporary. But there are very many black white families who are poor a lot, and particularly in a rural community like in Wisconsin. There's people who are definitely poor. They may live off the farm, but they may still have a lot of challenges. But also across this country, there are many white people who we have not taken the advantage of learning what are some of their challenges and barriers. Even though they still have better outcomes, there still is a lot of challenges and barriers for those families as well. And that's what I really appreciate about this study. They really have made us made me as an academic be forced to acknowledge my own bias towards leaning towards a black and brown study versus there are white people out there, too, who are having some challenges.
So what were some of the other factors attributed to children of all races and all groups having a successful outcome?
Well, the one thing that they said, too, success in school is a vehicle by which children who are privileged are able to take advantage of that. I mean, you and I both have had the advantage of having parents who have been educated and have those privileges. And it's very clear there. They can see that. However, they said with the white kids, there's still something also around even being in school. The teachers will kind of lean towards them and see them as more acceptable and more apt to be successful. So they may get some more, they may get more attention around their academic achievement. They also talked about the whole idea that whites from the same backgrounds are accessed to, again, and I have to reiterate it one more time, this whole idea of higher wage employment. But also they said that the one thing I thought was really interesting was that black women get more jobs, but they still are getting less pay. So even with the few black men who were able to get jobs, women who were black and working were still worse off than black men who were working. But white men and white women were doing better because the white women had the privilege of the white men who were working. So they, if they were married, who generally was a white partner, there was an additional privilege that came with that. So two low-income white people who are working together are going to do better in the majority of times than two low-income black people who may get married.
It sounds like for black women, they're faced with a double whammy of mm-hmm. challenges. I want to know a little bit more about their situation. What were things that helped them to achieve well-being? Mm-hmm. And what were some of the additional barriers that they faced?
I mean, for many of the women in this particular study, one of the things was that they did lean towards graduation. I mean, graduation still is a big key. The fact that they did go to school. And the fact also, they said a big factor is that if they were able to get a job while they were in high school was a big deal. Unfortunately, for many black kids in our country, the unemployment rate for black teenagers is like ridiculously high, like over 65% black kids do not get a job. And that's one of the ways that you will find through research that we have seen makes a big difference. So some of these young women were able to secure jobs while they were in high school, graduate from high school, and then get a job right out of high school. And it may have been through their receipt of a TANF check, because TANF is a work-based program now. So having a child allowed them that opportunity. But for many of the black men, the only way they've been able to get any type of employment opportunity was if they were involved in the criminal justice system or if they were involved in the child support system. And so many of them lost that opportunity. They don't have the job skills because they weren't able to get, they didn't commit either one of the, they didn't commit a crime or have a baby, which we would not want people to do when they're young. But that was the only way they had access to getting work was if they committed a crime or they had a baby, because then there was some other basis of a program that provided an access. For the women also, delaying pregnancy. I mean, that's a big deal. Some of them delayed having children. So it was no one factor, but the main factor was education. But the multitude of factors, such as having a baby and not being involved in drugs or not being incarcerated, made a big difference as well. You find more of that on the male side, the incarceration rate, because they gave us a small sample of men in particular at two schools that had the most poverty. And for the black men, out of the 22 they interviewed, 18 of them had some incarceration contact. For the white men of the ones they interviewed, 11 of them of the 20 of the 18 they interviewed hadn't. So it was still very high on both sides. But still, as you mentioned earlier with the Divide Pager study, those white men were still able to get jobs. So it really is a very simplistic answer. Education and you get a job. And that makes the biggest difference that they came down with after this 25-year study. But the thing that was unique was it still showed with the same type of demographics, white men are still going to do better.
So what do we take from this? I mean, it seems simplistic, right? Mm-hmm. But it's really not. As we're talking about this and we're digging into this, there are so many factors that are coming together to determine whether someone's going to achieve what we consider to be well-being or not, coming from these very humble beginnings. But what do we take from this? I mean, what do we go forward and do with this information?
You know, one thing I think that would be good for Milwaukee to do, and it's really on the onus of us as academic, me as an academic and also talking to people in the city, is that to look at what type of job opportunities do we provide for students when they're in high school and really push to have an opportunity for students to get work when they're young, because it really sets the standard of what they expect and how do you have good work behavior and how you develop a resume. We need to challenge our school system on a continuous basis because education is still the key. And if we have students such as I will often talk about students who I may receive at UW-Milwaukee who often have not been given the skills that they were supposed to get in high school, that we need to challenge the school system, not just the school system, but the community college system, and that we really want to make sure that we provide the academic rigor that people need to have to be able to meet the challenges of a global world that's changing and really becoming more technologically sound. We need to also look at the amount of violence people live in and what does the trauma do to people where they're living in places where they hear consistent gunshots or they're dealing with seeing violence in their community. Because what we have found, and this study only touched on it lightly, but other studies I know of friends who have done work around the country, the amount of anxiety that people tend to develop over time from being exposed to violence on a regular basis does not allow for good study skills and good comfort level around getting your work done. You have so many other things to worry about that you can't do that. So we need to attend to just really reducing the violence in the communities and also providing good access to health care. I mean, they don't touch on it a whole lot, but the fact that you need to be sure that people have gotten all the shots they needed, that they've gotten all the immunizations they need to have, and we need to start with kids early in life. You know, this study really just showed that a lot of what happens to people when they become adults is really set by the parents they are born into. And I don't want to say I'm blaming these parents. It's just that we need to be very careful about not just doing things for kids, but doing things for their parents as well. It needs to be a family effort, because if you send in a kid back home who you think is doing well, if their parents still are struggling with the job or the kids see their parents always stressed out or these parents are interacting in a stressful way, it's not going to allow that kid to be the full person they can be. So we need to really do more policy around looking at the total family, not just individuals and in silos.
Well, thanks, David.
Thank you again for a wonderful opportunity to talk about another study.
David Pate is Lake Effect's Real Talk contributor on race, gender, and class issues. He's an associate professor in UW-Milwaukee's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, and he's the founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice. Coming up next, we hear about a Sherman Park resale shop that doubles as work training for some Milwaukee youth. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Before the break, we heard Real Talk contributor David Pate explain some of the factors that helped children who grew up in low-income homes achieve success later in life. One of those factors was the ability to work in a job as a young person. Helping youth get that critical experience is at the heart of the Youth Employment Services, or YES, program. It's run by the Milwaukee nonprofit St. Charles Youth and Family Services, Inc., a social service agency that serves at-risk youth and their families. Last year, St. Charles opened Repurpose, a nonprofit resale shop in Sherman Park, to serve as a training ground for these young people to learn on-the-job work skills. I visited Repurpose last year shortly after its opening to learn more about the YES program and spoke with St. Charles' Scott Carpenter. He describes where we were sitting.
We are in the back classroom of the Repurpose resale store, and it's the classroom where we utilize to teach our young people who are in our program. We spend the first month, two nights a week, in this back room, and we teach them all the stuff that preps them to work in retail and customer service types of jobs. And so it's a great place. The kids are able to learn a lot of the stuff that they need to be successful in their first parts of work. And so this is where it starts.
Well, tell me about the genesis of the YES program. How did it get started? What need were you responding to when St. Charles began this?
What happens is when we're working with young people in any kind of form, whether it's in alternative education, residential treatment, any of those areas, kids want to work. Hey, can you get me a job? Hey, you know, can you hire me here? They want to work. And many times there's not a lot of opportunity for them to work. And you pair that with some barriers that they might have to enter into the workforce, and we're kind of setting up kids not to be successful. So what we started to do is say, hey, let's take a look at how we can do this. And we worked with some funding sources to say, let's work at how we can put together a program that helps young people become successful in their entry to the workforce. And so we started with custodial care stuff, and we started to train them in custodial care and how to do things properly and how to be safe with what they do. We also brought online a food service training, and now our third area is in retail and customer service. And with those three, we figure that we are hitting a lot of the entry-level jobs that young people would be walking into in some way, shape, or form. And we said, let's make this commitment. Let's leverage resources that St. Charles has as an organization, and let's create a meaningful training experience and then a work opportunity for young people to learn both the soft skills and hard skills that are needed in those different areas.
What have been the opportunities that these young people have missed out on that this provides them with? I mean, what are the struggles that they're facing in their lives outside of the program that makes this the opportunity that it is?
One of our young people, when asked kind of what brought him here, he summed it up very well and said, I hung out with the wrong crowd. And you can read into that, because when people hang out with the wrong crowd, they can get themselves in trouble. They can go down a lot of different paths. And I don't want to paint that as a broad brush with all of our young people. Some might be struggling with some emotional issues, or some might be struggling with court issues or academic issues or family issues. It's hard to kind of clump things all together. Their struggles are real. Their struggles are real. Sometimes they're systemic. Some families may not be very supportive. Some of them may not have a strong family connection. They might be in foster care or in group homes or in residential treatment. So they come in from all different situations. And I think the opportunity really is there's not a lot out there for young people to do in the realm of training for jobs. And so I think that this is a great opportunity that the general public doesn't have a lot of, and it's a good opportunity to keep them busy, keep them occupied into something positive. Many of them will say, when I ask, why do you want to work? I want to stay out of trouble. I want to stay busy. I want to be productive. I want to earn money so I can be independent. And that's reality for them. They don't want to have to rely on other people. They're 16, 17, 18-year-olds that are looking at independence. And that's a reality for anybody that age.
You mentioned the barriers that some of your students would be facing. Can you talk a little bit more about those?
Sure. Sometimes the barriers are anything from lack of opportunity, lack of confidence, feeling like some of our young people have to struggle with their past, and so they can't move forward. And so this is kind of a clean slate for them. And we say, this is building your work reputation. This is a different reputation for you, and this is how you can show that you can do something different in your life. There's other barriers, like sometimes it's transportation, or sometimes it's, you know, life happens to our young people. And sometimes the biggest struggle that they have is figuring out how to balance life and when things happen and still be committed to work. We're not expecting our young people to be perfect. We're expecting them to learn, and sometimes even learning from, I'm overwhelmed right now, I can't do this right now, and having that conversation with a boss about that is helpful, even though it might not be how we would traditionally look at work. When there's those hiccups, we want them to make sure that they are learning the proper way of dealing with those things. Don't burn bridges. Don't just not show up. Don't do no call, no show. Those are the things that we're working with them every day to do. And so that's part of the soft skills. That's part of the coaching. It's part of the whole experience. This is not just teaching a skill and then it magically appears. It's really about coaching them and what happens when and how do you handle that and how do you talk to your boss about that and how do you get through that and still hold your job.
So how does the process even begin? Does a student, young person come to you and say, gee, I'd like to learn this stuff, or are you kind of recruiting out there in the community?
Well, we're working with part of Milwaukee County who allows us to do this as a service for their clients. And so they refer to the YES program. And what happens is we take a look at pretty much every referral and say, what's going to match your skills the best? A lot of our young people have been said no to a lot. And so we say, come on in. Let's get this started. Let's try this. Let's establish some, you know, professional expectations, and let's see if you can rise to that.
Let's say yes.
And yeah, let's say yes to this. Let's not say no. And it's really through that process where they are going to say, this is an opportunity, and I'm going to show that I can show up on time, and I'm going to show that I can show every day for work, and I'm going to learn, and I'm going to develop my resume, and I'm going to learn interview skills, and I'm going to do all those things. And the vast majority of the kids just soak it up. They love this concept. They love being proud of their paychecks and of their staff recognition and their YES shirts that say now they're part of the crew and when they get their certificates and all of those things that go along with work that many times adults forget are positive things because it's the grind of work. But our young people, for the first time, they're excited about their work permits and they're excited about, you know, how did I do in my interview and all of those things. And you can just see the enthusiasm with them. And I think it's beneficial.
So when you have a young person refer to you, you figure out kind of where they might begin. Do they immediately go into classes? How does the teaching begin?
We start, we're able to work with them for 4 months. And so each track, whether it's custodial care or food service or retail, starts with the first month of class. And it's about 30 hours of class time. We set up our teaching environment to be 3 hours during their class time. The first hour and a half is typically classroom experience. So we're teaching the skills of how to create a resume, how to find a job, how to interview. We're teaching the custodial care stuff. We're teaching how to work with customers. We're teaching all of those things depending on which track they're in. And then we take the other half of the night and we spend it practicing. So if they learn how to clean the bathroom tonight, they're out practicing cleaning the bathroom. If they learned how to price items and sort items in a resale store, they're out doing that. If we're talking about how to deal with difficult customers, then we play the role of difficult customers and challenge them a little bit and see how they respond. And sometimes they do really well and sometimes they freeze, and that's reality. But that is how they learn and how they... We'd rather have them do that with people they're comfortable with than get out into the workforce and just freeze in a job. And so we tell our young people, this is practice time. We don't expect you to be perfect. We want you to try. And it'll be a safe place to try and to learn. And we're going to push you a little bit. We're going to challenge you a little bit. But it is really about how do you get past all that stuff so that when you work in the workforce, you are prepared?
After class, then does the real work start?
Yes. Then after that first month, if they are able to complete all of their obligations and earn their certificates and pass all of their curriculum, they then earn a spot on our crews. And so then they work for 3 months and they get scheduled like part-time work and they get paid like part-time work and they have different bosses at that point and they get feedback and evaluation and all the stuff that goes along with the job. We sometimes have an extra understanding of some of the struggles, and so we might be a little bit more patient with them if they are saying that something's happening at home and I struggled to get to work, and we try to correct that, and we bring all of our resources to the table so that we can see if they can make that turn, learn, and grow from that. So for 3 months, they're able to then be a part of that work crew, and then post that, then we start to work with them to try to find jobs in the community in areas that would be similar to what they're doing here.
Now, given the economy and how difficult it is for people to find jobs, just in general, are the young people who are going through the YES program, are they finding it difficult after they've gone through it, or does it really give them a leg up?
It gives them a little bit of a leg up. Our career coaches work with different organizations to kind of help create some inroads and to talk about our training. And what we're able to really do is say to employers, hey, we got some of the basics already covered. We're teaching them the safety stuff. We're teaching them how to use things properly, how to do those basic things. And we can say, here is their track record in 4 months of work. This is what their attendance has been like, so on and so forth. So it still is a struggle. I'm not going to say that it's not. But I think that they have a much more competitive advantage than if they didn't have this. Because sometimes it's just our young people anywhere sometimes just don't know what they don't know. They might not know what to wear to an interview or what to say in an interview or what to avoid when you're introducing yourself or all of those things. And we go over all those things. So even that, we've heard from employers, that sets them apart. They know what to do. They come in with a more professional demeanor than somebody else just walking off the street and saying, hey, are you looking for anybody to work here? You know, so I think it provides them with a really good foundation for them to get started.
Well, tell me about what goes on here at the store. Once the young people graduate into the actual job, you know, what are they doing each day?
Yeah, and they are. They start out as interns. We talk about that, and then they become store clerks. And so the program is built on kind of that graduation to the next step. What do they do every day? They do everything from greeting customers, they're working the register, they are doing back of the house stuff, sorting donations, cleaning donations. They are a part of cleaning the store, making sure that the store looks nice. They're a part of every part of our running.
So most of your customers, do they know about the broader mission of the store, that, you know, it is a training ground for young people for future employment?
We take every opportunity to tell them that, and they love it. And they say, this is why I want to do business here, or I'm going to come back, or I'm going to tell everybody, or can I take a flyer, or my church group has got to get here. Word spreads. They understand as well that young people need these types of opportunities. And so, yeah, we're not afraid of putting our mission right out there in front and letting everybody know.
Well, Scott Carpenter, thank you so much for giving us a little insight into the YES program.
Thank you so much.
Scott Carpenter is the Vice President of Organizational Development for the Milwaukee Social Services Agency, St. Charles Youth and Family Services, Inc. It runs the YES program, teaching at-risk youth job skills out of its repurpose resale shop in Sherman Park. You can hear some of the young YES program participants talk about their work as supplemental audio on wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A break now, and in just a moment, an author from Wisconsin puts a spin on the traditional book tour. He's doing it by bike. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Stephanie Lecce. Northern Wisconsin native Brian Benson has his first book under his belt and is just winding down through the last stretch of a Minnesota-Wisconsin-Illinois book tour by bike. A narrative nonfiction, Going Somewhere, tells the story of his cross-country bike trip from his parents' driveway in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin, to Portland, Oregon. Benson's tale involves personal growth, physical pain, bicycle breakdowns, and a woman named Rachel. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met the author on Milwaukee's East Side on Thursday as he prepared for a book reading at Boswell Book Company. Benson describes the success of his tour as mixed, in the best sense, of course. In Duluth, he enjoyed a stimulating conversation with the two people who showed up, while in his hometown, 150 people packed into the town hall.
My kindergarten teacher was in Land O'Lakes. So much fun, right? There was
Did
one.
Did she point out any corrections?
She didn't. No. I mean, maybe she was doing it in the audience. I don't know. But that was really the Land O'Lakes one in particular was fun because the population of that town is something like 500 or 600 people, and just a reminder of why I love being from there. In small towns, you know, people turn out and are so supportive. So.
So, what kind of reactions are you getting? Are people reacting to, you know, everything you went through physically and, you know, the grueling parts of and exciting parts of a cross-country tour or the relationship that you were working through at the time or both?
You know, kind of all the different things that I tried to hit on in the book have come up at different times, and I can never really predict what somebody's going to pull out and want to talk about. You know, some people have definitely connected with the physicality of it and the biking and just what it feels like, the wind especially, you know, the role that plays in a trip and how crazy making it can be, you know.
And the water.
Yeah, definitely. You know, people have definitely also talked about their relationship, and that's where I've gotten kind of mixed reviews on it. And it's actually something I expected because I tried to be really honest about what I was thinking the entire time, which were some not so generous thoughts at a lot of different points during the trip. And people have definitely had a lot to say about that, you know. I think both within the bike trip and also just within any kind of relationship, you can get to that point when the butterflies wear off where you're, especially on this trip, you know, unshowered and malnourished and not really at your best, you know.
And one of you is maybe more psyched than the other to be
definitely
continuing,
right,
on the road.
And one of you is also maybe, you know, a foot taller. And just genetically more predisposed to build muscle. And so there are just all these complicating factors. And so I think people have definitely taken note of that. And then also just, I think especially people in or around my generation, just this kind of existential aimlessness and sense of where am I going and how do I move forward. That's what actually motivated me to write the book. And it became both, I wasn't even expecting it to be kind of a love story book, you know. I'd started writing it at a point when that wasn't something I was focusing on as much, but I feel like those three things, the relationship, the trip itself, and then also the larger sense of where am I going is what people have responded to, which makes me really excited.
So for people who haven't, you know, looked at it yet, talk about what led to this book, but before that, meeting Rachel, who is the person you traveled with, where you met, and you had graduated from UW, right?
Right, yeah. You know, I graduated from UW-Madison with a lib arts double major, and I had a million really vague ideas about what I wanted to do, most of them related to some type of activism, and I, you know, had a sense that I was going to go out and somehow make the world a better place. But I couldn't decide, you know, which thing I wanted to focus on, and had a lot of anxiety around that, particularly because I just know how much privilege I have and had, and wanted to do something that, you know, that fit that. And I couldn't figure out what it was. So a friend and I actually saved up some money and decided to go on this trip we thought it was going to be a backpacking trip from Mexico to Argentina. And we spent months saving, like a year saving actually, and so much time planning and getting all these destinations figured out. And after 4 weeks, I just realized that I hated backpacking because it was just sitting on buses and feeling like this really pampered tourist, and I wasn't even enjoying it. So again, with the privilege, you know, feeling really guilty about that. And so I stopped in Western Guatemala in the city of Quetzaltenango, and pretty quickly after getting there, I met a guy who invited me to come to a jazz show that it turned out a friend of his was singing in the band, and that was Rachel, this woman that I ended up taking the trip with. And, you know, from the very instant I met her, she's beautiful and was captivated in that way, but also she was so focused and knew clearly what she was doing, was really embedded there and had a lot of things going on. It would make these big decisions really quickly and not look back. And one of them was that she mentioned wanting to take a bike trip across the States and, you know, remained really focused on that. And as soon as she brought it up, we'd been dating sort of at that point for a little bit. I just latched onto the idea, both because it was something specific to do and a way to, you know, romantically and vaguely move out into the world with her. So that's really how it ended up happening.
When did you start writing? In the book, you talk about journaling and that you look back at pages and pages that you wrote. Way before then, were you a writer in the making?
I've always loved to write. I wrote journals all the time. I've been accused by a friend of writing the world's most unnecessarily beautiful emails. So I guess I channeled a lot of it into there. And then research papers. You know, I was a history and international studies major in Madison, and I always loved doing those essays and got really, really into those papers. But I hadn't done much creative writing with the exception of a magazine that I got to edit for a little bit in Quetzaltenango for just 4 or 5 months. And I tried to figure out why that was, and I think I trace it back to, you know, the Gifted and Talented program. So my sister and I were both in it when I was in, I think, fourth grade. And for anybody who doesn't know what that is, it's, you know, students get pulled out of class if they're seen to be, I don't know, possessing some exceptional talents or whatever. It's a very kind of
brilliant
odd program. Yeah. It's an interesting kind of weird program. But we get pulled out once a week to go to another school in the area and spend an hour or two doing gifted and talented things like making origami and building bridges out of toothpicks. And the really weird thing about it was that Leah, my sister, got put into the creative group and I was put in the intellectual group. And there was this split. It baffles me that they do this. But I didn't realize until a couple of years ago how profound of an impact that it had. Because anytime somebody would accuse me of being creative, you know, I play music as well, and I draw, like to do a lot of fairly artistic things, I would just think, if not say, no, Leah's creative, I'm smart. And that was a big difference to me, you know? And it took me a long time to actually kind of give myself permission to try to do something creative. I also just, you know, I got really really radicalized when I was in Madison, and it felt like I wasn't allowed to do any creative writing because that somehow wasn't helping the cause, whatever the cause was at any given point. So yeah, it took kind of wading through a lot of my own hang-ups, you know, planted by others or myself to get to the point where I really felt comfortable writing. And I've loved finding my way to it. It's been really great.
You said you started this book with a sort of central scene, the lost chocolate. Talk about that.
I did, yeah. You know, I'd been kind of darting around writing the book for a while. I started it right after the trip ended, and I couldn't really figure out how to get into it. I'd never tried writing a book before, and writing something long form it's a big endeavor. And so I just chose this anecdote that I had been thinking about and told people about a lot when I got just so mad at Rachel for losing two bad chocolate bars, not even good chocolate, I mean Hershey's or something like that. And it wasn't just that she had lost chocolate, it was that she had become the kind of person who loses chocolate, which meant something really important at the time. I can't tell you what it is anymore. But so I thought about that a bunch, and it seemed to me like that there were so many moments like that on the trip where I just blew up nothing into everything, that it was a part of that trip and also of so many relationships, right? And so I decided to write something based around that. Also because North Dakota was there were so many things that happened in that state and the wind was such a force, and it was when things really shifted in our trip. So I wrote a chapter and really focused on honing that chapter. I wasn't calling it a chapter at that point. It was its own standalone thing. I wasn't admitting I was writing a book yet. But I really got that super tight and had all these arcs and sub-themes and subtext that were playing into that. And then when I started the book, I began from the beginning and wrote up to that. And as any writer who's listening will realize, that meant that I got to do so much editing eventually, because, you know, I wasn't thinking about the larger arcs of the whole book and how characters should be written. So I got up to that point and figured, oh, I can just skip right over this chapter and move to the next one, and then looked at it and realized, oh boy, I have a lot of work to do.
5 years after you reached Portland, you returned by bike. It was a solo trip.
It was.
And you shifted from a Fuji to...
So this is a Soma frame that is now powder-coated blue and is named Rudolph.
Lovely, yeah, for your grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah, my grandfather, when he was conscripted into the military, didn't have a middle name and everybody else did, so he made up Rudolph on the spot, which is brilliant. So yeah, this bike is one that I had help building from some coworkers at a place, the Community Cycling Center. It's a nonprofit that there's something.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there's something I know really similar in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I found that and started volunteering when I got there and met some really wonderful folks who helped me build this bike up from the frame, which has been fun for a lot of reasons. You know, it's great being able to ride this and remembering that I built it, but especially being able to depend on it a little bit more. I had the wheels, especially I learned how to build wheels for this bike, which is, you know, a really satisfying thing to do. And it's also great to know the time that was taken to build those wheels up, because I didn't have that with the Fuji. I had factory built wheels, and at the time I didn't really know what that meant, but basically it means a machine fires the spokes into the wheel really quick and ups the tension in a matter of about 30 seconds. And if you've ever built a wheel, you know that you slowly increase the tension on all the spokes, which is why it actually works. But when you do the robotic approach, it's pretty common for spokes to break, which happened many, many times on that trip, including on the second day. So yeah, I love being on this bike. It is it's a lot more dependable, and it's been really fun riding it around the state for the last month.
So how would you contrast going back to the first trip and then your return on this bike 5 years later? How do you sort of assess your evolution over that time?
I think there are a few things that I've learned since that initial trip. One of them being to just not worry about things. You know, I really was freaked out about when the spokes started to blow and when I couldn't decide which direction we should take on the trip. I would spend a lot of time just agonizing over it. And I've learned that one of the most fun things, actually, is when things go wrong. Maybe not in that exact moment when the thing goes wrong, but it always leads you to meeting such kind, generous people. And so another thing along those lines is being very okay with asking for help. I think that, you know, I personally and we culturally learn to be individuals, right? And to be as atomized as possible and not need to depend on others. And so it's a really difficult thing to say repeatedly to people you don't know, to people who, if you were in the same city, actually, you might be better off then, to be able to say, I really could use some help with a place to stay or some water or a ride to get something fixed. And you know, I've been in the situation on the other side where somebody asks me for something and it feels so good to need and be needed. And I don't think we get that experience enough with strangers. So just to be pushed out of my comfort zone and let myself do that on a fairly regular basis is a really great part of the trip.
So what's your cause these days? Or are you not cause oriented, rather writing project oriented?
I don't know that I would say that I have one cause, but I definitely still think about and I'm committed to social justice work. And so what I'm doing right now in Portland, principally for work, is this place called Right Around Portland. It's a nonprofit that's been around for 15 years, and I've been working and volunteering for the past year and a half. And what Right Around Portland does is offer 10-week workshops in prisons, affordable housing, treatment centers, and a lot of different places where people have stories to tell but probably don't have encouragement to share them, or definitely access to writing workshops. And so they're these prompt-based workshops where people get the chance to do a lot of free writing and a lot of revising and talk about craft without ever actually saying the word craft. And a lot of, you know, peer review and constructive feedback. And at the end of the workshop, everybody gets the opportunity to publish one of their pieces in an anthology that's beautiful. It's designed by someone we've worked with for a while who gives us this ridiculously low rate. And there's a big reading where 200-some people come, and it's a pretty incredible thing. So I get to work with all the writers and with a bunch of volunteers who help us put that book together 3 times a year. So it's pretty great. You know, I just kind of stumbled into that job with the newer focus on writing, and it feels like a mashup of a lot of the different things I'm really passionate about. So I hope to be there for a while.
Brian Benson's first book is titled Going Somewhere. WUWM's Susan Benz talked with the author before his appearance last night at Boswell Book Company. Tomorrow, Benson finishes the Midwest leg of his tour at City Lit Books in Chicago. Benson will be traveling in on Rudolph, the bicycle named in honor of his grandfather who lives in Chicago. He plans to finish reading his grandson's book before Benson arrives in town. We'll take one last break and then return with an audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. Stay tuned. Lake Effect returns on WUWM right after this. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Lake Effect on Fridays until the end of September. Here's this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's 7 blocks from the Modjeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we're sharing the voices and sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
The big culture, the big American culture, is individualistic. I'm the most important thing. Basically, it's me, whereas American Indians are tribal. The group will always trump the individual, always. Our culture is future-oriented. We're always thinking ahead. You take and you save for retirement. You have to have your 5-year plan. American Indians are present-oriented. Today's the day. Tomorrow, don't put too much thought on that, because by the time it comes, it's today again. Time is looked at in the big culture like a line, linear, whereas in the Indian culture, cyclical. So when you look at life as a circle, you want to be careful what you do, because if you put something bad on that circle, it's going to come right back at you.
Listening to Mitchell is a public art project by Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr. The project's 18-channel immersive audio installation at 723 West Historic Mitchell Street is open Thursdays and Fridays from 3 till 6:30, as well as Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m. To learn more about Listening to Mitchell events and happenings, you'll find a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And don't forget, you can hear the next radio installment in the series next Friday on Lake Effect. That's all the time we have today. We're produced by Mitch Tyke, Dan Harmon, and Bonnie North, with web assistance from Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering from John Strelecki, and production assistance from Brooke Dowden, Eleanor Peterson, and Audrey Nowakowski. I'm Stephanie Lecce, thanking you for tuning in, as you've done every day for my 6 years on Lake Effect. This is my last show, and I've loved every minute of every conversation we've gotten to share. So long, Milwaukee, and thanks for all the fish. Join Lake Effect again tomorrow and Sunday for Lake Effect Weekend starting at 3 p.m. and back here again on Monday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.